Hi, everyone, and welcome to Show 1 of the Retro Computing Roundtable podcast. This is a show where podcasters, bloggers, collectors, educators, and just plain enthusiasts of computer history get together and talk about recent events and, yes, even news concerning our hobby. Will I ever find my way back to us? Plus, how recent tech news relates to our computing past. I'm your host, David Grealish of ClassicComputing.com, where I blog and produce two other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast and Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. On today's show, we are joined by an interesting and diverse group of individuals. So first, there's Bill Degnan of Landenburg, Pennsylvania. He teaches the History and Preservation of Historical Microcomputers class at the University of Delaware. He's also the vice president of MARCH, which is the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists. And MARCH organizes the VCFE, which is the Vintage Computer Festival East, at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey. Hey, Bill.
Yes.
How you doing today, this morning?
Doing fabulous. Thank you.
And you were actually, you told me you're not at your home site, Landenburg, but you're in where right now, Delaware?
Yeah, I'm in Wilmington, Delaware, and I'm in my computer repair shop, which is a unique shop in that it repairs not just new computers but old ones. Mm-hmm. And we've got a classic computing gallery on, in every nook and cranny. There's interesting shelving units holding computers and technology from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s.
Very cool. And that just opened today, right?
It actually the ribbon cutting was Wednesday. And the mayor came out, and there was a big, gigantic scissors.
Really?
And so it made it official, yes. And really, I wanted to make it more like an art gallery than a gigantic pile and collection of computers. But I'll talk a little bit about that later.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. And I definitely, I don't know if you intend on this at some point, but maybe you'll videotape it and... You know, so us who can't be there in person can look inside your shop and museum. But maybe
yes.
Sometime real soon you can get some pictures and, you know, get them to me and I'll put them up on the feed here.
Okay.
Or
yeah, I have posted some pictures, but they're in the raw form.
Okay. So I'll be bugging you for those.
Yes.
So next up we have Earl Evans, and he is from Portland, Oregon, and he is what I call the godfather of the computer history podcast, the Retro Bits podcast, which was the when I personally first started listening to podcasts, which I guess was summer of 06 when I kind of discovered them. You know, I thought, what do I want to listen to? I wasn't really psyched about it, but, you know, I looked into it. I said, well, maybe there's one about computer history. And so I found Earl's. So hi, Earl.
Hi, good morning, David.
So yours was, man, was your podcast was not to make it all past tense because I know you're still going on, but gosh, it was great, and it was very regular for a while there.
Yeah, it used to be every week. Now it's a little less regular, and it's been going for about 5 years at this point, a little over 5 years. So I've enjoyed it. Computing's always been a favorite topic of mine, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later in this roundtable, but. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that RetroBits is still going, still having fun at it.
Yeah, so you actually started it like in 05, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's true.
So that was pretty early on in the whole movement.
So yeah, I got inspired by a couple of podcasts that I really liked, and I thought, let's give it a try.
Good, and good to have you. And next we have Carrington Vanston, and he hails from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And he is well known for the 1 Megahertz and Apple II podcast, another one of my favorites. And hi, Carrington.
Hello.
Hey. And for all of us knucklehead Americans, don't know much about Canada, see, Quebec is the furthest most east part, right?
No, not even close.
No?
There's like five
Is that Ontario then?
I'm in Ontario. East of us would be Quebec, but there's the whole Maritimes east of that. There's
Nova Scotia,
New Brunswick, Newfoundland.
Okay. Well, you know, the
Labrador.
I could look it up on the internet, too. But anyway, I was kind of close.
Yes, very, very close, yes.
But really good to have you. And you're also, you've kind of been on hiatus with the 1 Megahertz.
That's right, yeah.
But you told me you have a new one coming up?
I do, yeah. I got a sponsor, so I've been sort of cajoled into starting up again. But I'm actually really looking forward to it. The first episode was recorded last weekend. I think it goes live today or something. It'll be today or tomorrow. It's just sort of getting vetted by the sponsors the first time through, the first episode. And it'll be biweekly, so I'm really excited to get back into it. Yeah, I've been doing the Apple II stuff for years and years and years. I just got too busy to sort of record my hobby, and I'm looking forward to it.
And just to put it out there, if you listen to Carrington's podcasts, some of the other episodes, he mentions that, and we discussed this last night, Carrington, briefly, that you've been at it a long time, so you actually built an Altair as a young boy.
I did, yeah, real computer was an Altair. Yeah, I was at it since I was just a wee lad. My parents sort of had no idea, what am I doing? First he's taking apart the VCR, now he's I was one of those kids, like probably everyone who listens to these sort of things, took apart everything. But yeah, my first computer was an 8800.
Excellent. And just lastly to mention, one thing I like about Carrington's podcast, it's an audio podcast, so obviously no visuals, but Carrington would regularly, get software and open it up for the first time and just describe it and play with it, and it's really well done. So
I get a lot of heat for that, though. Holy cow. The collector's just writing in. I still get people writing in. I'm just so upset at me for that, because I really enjoy the experience of sort of reliving that new feel. I like getting a new piece of software. I liked it as a kid. So I enjoy grabbing the freshly sealed copy of Lode Runner or whatever and ripping open the shrink wrap and playing it for the first time. But yeah, I then would inevitably get the deluge of very angry collectors writing in. Saying, I would have given you a box. What are you doing?
So. Yeah, I'm a firm believer in I collected a few other things, and I'm a firm believer of using them. So, like, for instance, if it's a toy or something, and it's – I mean, I take it out. Yeah, it's going to get used, and maybe it's going to get dirty, and it's not going to be pristine. But what's the point of having something in a box sitting up on a shelf, with some exception?
I do get it, though. Like, I mean, I get the collecting impulse. I don't have it myself. I'm more of a use it and then donate it back to a listener sort of guy. But I totally understand the argument that if there's thousands and thousands of already opened boxes of a particular piece of software or hardware why does this crazy Canadian have the need to rip open one of the, say, dozen remaining shrink wrap copies? And other than saying I have an impulse control problem, I really have no excuse. So I do understand it. I just can't seem to resist it.
All right, now it's the time of the show. We're going to talk about news items. So first up is a recent documentary that was, and I'm not sure, was this actually aired on television or did it only exist on the internet? But it was a feature called Bloomberg's Game Changers, and they did a number of individuals, but the one I highlighted was Steve Jobs. Does anyone know, was this actually aired on television as well?
I'm not sure. I know I watched it online, but I don't have actual television anymore. I just have a TV to watch DVDs. So I don't even know if Bloomberg stuff shows in Canada, but I did watch it online.
I watched it, of course, and I really enjoyed it. There wasn't a lot of stuff that I didn't know already. And, darn it, it was probably right when it came out, so I can't remember specifics about it. But there were a few things that were surprising.
There were a couple of things that surprised me, because I only know the history of Jobs and stuff like that from the outside. I've never read a biography of him, that sort of thing. So I didn't know, for instance, that after he got ousted, he sold all but one share of his Apple stock, which I found a sort of petulant but probably a fitting sort of move for him. I thought that was very interesting. And I didn't know that – I liked that at the beginning they talked about how when these guys met him, he had hair down to his waist and he was a total hippie. And it's just such a different – a different image than I have of him as the hardcore business guy. So I found that interesting.
Yeah, in general, I feel that the this is Bill. In general, I feel that the emphasis on Steve Jobs has over time increased, perhaps not proportionate to the actual contribution. That there have been many others involved. He's the personality. But I think that from my readings and from people that I know who have met him in the earlier days, he was a very, very important person. He was absolutely probably the most important person, but yet there's an awful lot of the negative or the mistakes, for example, the Apple III and his contribution to that and so on, that might you want to be careful that you're reading a balanced biography and that you're not adding to the mythos, but still, instead, you want to try to find the original sources and read those instead of just read the rehashed Wikipedia-like documentaries.
Right. And Carrington, about the one share, what I've read before is that, of course, he sold everything except for one share, so he would still receive the yearly stock, market information
totally
from Apple.
Fitting, yeah.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it, so I certainly recommend anyone listening to check it out. You know, this kind of, I think I can't fight the urge that I'll go ahead and bring up a related news issue here, is that John Sculley interview, which was done by the Cult of Mac.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
Yeah, Leander, I agree. That was fascinating.
Leander Connie? He does the website Cult of Mac. He used to work for Wired. He's done a couple of books. I think I have the Cult of Mac book, and he also did the Inside Steve's Brain book, which is pretty good. And I think he did one about the iPod. Yeah, so this is like the first time John Sculley has really been interviewed in any depth about Steve Jobs since Steve's ouster, or I guess really since John Sculley wrote a book in 87 called Odyssey. And anybody read that?
I didn't read that, but I do have a videotape from corporate that was sent out to all the computer clubs after Steve left. And it's very interesting. The change in tone that the company had during that brief period when he wasn't around. I'll have to put that on YouTube.
Yeah, I would really be interested in seeing that. As this article, of course, this interview, Leander also took it and used the Mac voice or whatever. You can actually download and listen to it, as a MP3, but it's the Mac voice talking. So I listened to it on my commute to work, and it's very very listenable. Is that the right word? It's very good. But John Sculley, just man, he definitely sings the praises of Steve Jobs. I think
it was a very self-deprecating interview. I agree. Yeah, which I found very interesting.
Lots of admiration for Jobs and, taking responsibility himself for a lot of the things that happened with Apple during that time period.
Yeah, I found that part actually the most interesting. That's a good point, Earl. I thought it was that he said, that he made two really dumb mistakes or whatever. The first that he asked, I guess as they were coming to the end of the Motorola processor's lifetime and wanted to know what to go with, and he took the advice to go with RISC instead of the six stuff, like basically went with the PowerPC instead of Intel. And he says that it was because he wasn't technically qualified to make that decision. And then the other one, which I think was even more interesting, he says that the other big failure was that if he had thought about it, they should have gone back to Steve. Like, it was about 1993 or something, and he wanted to leave Apple, and the board had decided to try to sell Apple. So Sculley was instructed to go and shop it around, and they went to companies like AT&T and IBM, and just nobody wanted to even buy Apple. And Sculley says if he'd had any sense, then he would have suggested they hire Steve back to come back and run the company. And I found that interesting, just that he would say that, and the fact that at that time none of these companies even wanted to touch Apple. And I bet they sort of would like to own it now. Of course, it would have been a completely different company if they'd bought it. But I found that very interesting. I found the whole self-deprecating tone that him sort of saying repeatedly that he was essentially unqualified for that job, I found very interesting in the article.
And I think, in a nutshell, what came out of it was basically, Steve Jobs made some mistakes. I don't know if John says that, but basically everything that John Sculley did over the next number of years was all Steve Jobs, going along the same, following Steve Jobs' philosophies. And so you basically skated on all the momentum that Steve Jobs built up, and especially with the Macintosh. And then, just how sorry he was of what happened. They should have tried harder to work with him. Maybe he could remain the CEO chairman, but somehow, be more balanced with other people helping make decisions.
Another thing that kind of inspired me about the article was, John Sculley was saying Steve Jobs didn't just want things to be functional. He wanted them to be beautiful.
Right.
And I think even in a modern day context, when you're going through your work or other things that you're doing, projects, it's an interesting component to try and build in. Don't just think, can I make this work, but maybe something along the lines of, can I make this really elegant? And I think that sometimes that gets lost in the busyness of projects and work, and so I just found that kind of inspiring for myself.
Bill, you're exactly right about there's some things maybe Steve Jobs gets too much praise about. He's Jesus basically coming back to Apple, but
I just think it's important to read the first-hand accounts. For example, the Apple III, the philosophy of making a computer beautiful probably was what made it a failure by not putting a fan in there,
right?
From a heating standpoint. So there has to be a counterbalance to almost anybody, or you get too much of one thing and not enough of the other. And you don't want to forget that the reason that you buy a computer in the end is so that it will compute and that it will do what it is you need it to do.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget about, like, the Cube.
Yeah.
The Apple Cube, which, you know, again, with the fan situation, I supported those in a job I worked at. And out of, like, a dozen of them over 2 years maybe, at least half of them went bad because of overheating issues and the fan and everything. So he certainly – but I do think the whole thing, like what Earl's saying about his attention to – design and attention to detail, that's definitely the strong point of Apple, one of the strong points of Apple now. So yeah, one thing that in that interview that I just think, does it come across anyone that John Sculley, I mean, obviously the regret comes out, but, you know, they obviously formed a very close relationship, a friendship, and I swear it seems like he's brokenhearted. Did that come across to anyone that he's, you know?
I got a little sense of that, yeah, I which I found very interesting as well, because what I knew sort of going into the interview was just sort of the broad 10,000-foot overview, which is, you know, Sculley was at Pepsi, comes to Apple, and then I had a vague sense that he was somehow responsible for giving Jobs the boot. I really haven't been aware of sort of the details of that relationship. I never really was that interested. So,
yeah.
I found it interesting to find out that they actually had a closer relationship. I had wondered, though, reading it, if maybe one of the things that Steve Jobs liked about John Sculley at the beginning was the fact that he wasn't technically qualified, or wasn't qualified in a technical way. Because I wonder if Steve Jobs, being the non-hippie guy I know now, thought, well, this is great. This is a guy that can be CEO that I can sort of bully or tech talk around, and I will be really in control here because this is a sugar water maker who doesn't know what he's talking about. And I wonder if that was part of the appeal.
Well, Steve wasn't that. He wasn't the one who actually invented any of the technological components of the computer itself.
That's not what Steve says.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it that he might have looked at them more along the Markula?
Yeah, Markula, yeah.
Markula. I think that's who he was looking to replace.
I think there's no doubt that, and some, you know, he was a young guy, it's still 1984, 85, so certainly having this older, you know, seasoned executive that he could maybe mentor him as this young guy, all of a sudden he can mentor an older, I think that had to play a little bit into it. But let's move along then. So we'll move into our next topic, our next item, which is David All's new old book. So Bill, you said you know something firsthand about this.
Well, I know I've met with David before. And he lives in New Jersey.
And he presented at the last Vintage Computer Festival.
Right, and he also was at Hope, and you know, he was there presenting with us. We had like an exhibit set up with different kinds of computers, and this is you know, something, you know, great as far as, you know, if you want to teach your children how to program, the basic programs that have been compiled. It's like a greatest hits reissue. It's a great way to learn the logic of computers without the graphical user interface. And the only complaint I guess I have about this is that the programs themselves aren't really compatible with an old computer. You can't download them and put them onto an original Microsoft BASIC or just standard BASIC computer. You would have to use the emulator that comes with the book that's linked to from the article. I thought that was interesting. But you know, it's definitely a something that, you know, before your children get too interested in the graphical user interface world, give them an opportunity to mess around with a computer that they have to type. I think it's a valuable experience for them.
Have you spoken to them about this book?
Not
directly, did you say?
Not directly. It came out, I guess it came out just recently because it was not on his list of things when I spoke to him. I guess it was July or whenever Hope was.
Yeah, I wonder why he chose to do that. I guess because other people aren't going to have access to old computers.
Right, exactly.
I'm looking on eBay, and there's at this right now, there's at least about, looks like 5, 6 or so different versions of that book. Some are like TRS-80 editions. Yeah, David H. All, Volume 2. Ooh. And they're getting some crazy prices, some of them.
Sure. It was one of the it was really one of the iconic early programming books. I mean, it was everywhere. I had a copy, at least one copy of it when I was young. I'd like to point out that the new republished one, although I should point first that I thought that was a really good point about the fact that the new one, all the code listings have been rewritten in Microsoft Small Basic. I thought that was a good thing that brought that up. It's a free download for XP people. I don't know what us Mac users will do. But anyway, the republished version comes in a couple of editions. And I think my advice, definitely, if you're going to pick this up, would be to go with the one with the George Beaker illustrations. I think it's Beaker. It's B-E-K-E-R. He's the one who does those little cartoony robot drawings. And if you get the sort of the lower cost version of this, it doesn't come with any illustrations. But the 17, or I think it's $17.50 edition of the new one, George Beaker came out of retirement to do new illustrations. So not only does it have all the old ones, you've got special one-time only new versions of those, or new illustrations for it. So to me, that's definitely the one to buy if you're going to go for this.
And mentioned too, it's only available as an ebook, and I'm not sure if you said that, Bill, but it's $14.95. This is, you know, this brings up a little bit of a debatable topic, I guess. You know, the next item I have down here is the 25th anniversary of the NES, which, is it a computer? You know, yes, but it's a game system, it's a console, it's very important, but, you know, I don't know if we want to discuss if this should be included or not, but does anybody have any comments about it? I'm not a big console person.
I think they're computing devices, obviously, and I think it's interesting from the perspective of, you know, even standard general-purpose computing is starting to now move the way of the console. You've got the latest batch of, for instance, mobile phones, which are computers, but are they a general-purpose computer? They are, but you can only get the applications in a prepackaged way. And I think I was reading a news article that maybe even there's a rumor the next version of the Mac operating system will move more towards, you know, that phenomenon. So I guess in that perspective, consoles are as much of a general purpose computing device as anything else. They're programmed by somebody else, and you're a consumer of the program.
I'd like to add that the Japanese version of this, Famicom.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking that.
My particular unit has the ability to record, has a disk drive attached to it, has the ability to record the RAM, which means that I could then extract and make changes to the programs themselves.
Really?
So it's not that far from being a computer, especially if you're a hacker, to be able to get in there. And then you could, in theory, recompile an NES game on the Famicom and put it on, make a cartridge and put it onto your NES and make actual, you know, whatever you want there. So I would say that it's got a microprocessor. I believe it's an 8085. Anybody?
I'm looking.
Have that one?
Let's see.
So aside from it not having a keyboard, you know, it's a computer.
So were you saying it was possible back in those days that you could have even homebrewed your own game?
Yes, especially if you had the, I don't know if they're aftermarket or legal or not legal, but I've got a number of devices that you can hook up to the Famicom that gives you the ability to grab the ROM and then write it to diskette, which is a special Nintendo-branded diskette drive from Japan.
Sure, the Famicom I have lets me write my own stuff if I want. It's got the little keyboard. It's that little. It's the standard. It's like not the super early one, but I've got the standard Famicom, the big one from 84 or whatever. So it's the red and white little edition. And yeah, it comes with the little keyboard, and you can copy games. You can write your own stuff. I have the little basic thing for it.
Did they ever sell those? Where did you guys get those? I mean, did they ever sell them in the States? Or you just got them like through the
No, I don't think so. I think the Famicom was just if I recall, it was in like 84 or whatever when Nintendo approached Atari to release the Famicom in North America, and then that's when it became the NES. And they decided, because remember, this is after the big
crash.
The big crash, exactly. And so the whole idea is like, we're going to make this a console. It's a strange sort of history. I think it was covered very well by One Up or whatever, that podcast that's sort of coming to an end. I think they just did a big show on the NES, the history. But yeah, that's the way I remember it. So the Famicom I got, though, I didn't own it back then. I bought it in the mid-90s or something off some listing online.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, the Famicom came out in July 83, and then it wouldn't be till October 85 for the United States, and then February 86 for Canada, September 86 for Europe. Well, you know,
there must have been HP and Columbia and a number of other computers that were hooked into these things. I mean, there must have been someplace there's some development environment systems that write to these cartridges and the ROMs that you know that are inside of them. And now I would love as a vintage computer person to have a development system where they were making the end product for the NES and whatnot.
Now, I remember with the NES, they had that whole Nintendo seal of quality thing, which because Nintendo, with very few exceptions for like the first, oh my goodness, like the first 5, 6, 7, 10 years of the life of the NES, Nintendo was the manufacturer of all the cartridges. You weren't allowed to make your own cartridges. So you would send your code basically to Nintendo. They would manufacture the cartridges and ship them back to you, which is why with popular games, like Castlevania or whatever, it would simply sell out and it would be 8 months later before other things would show up because it would take that long to get new ones manufactured from Japan. So yeah, there was really tight controls on that. And then there was somebody, oh my goodness, I'm totally unprepared for this, but I know there was some company that figured out that the code for that little chip they put inside that basically was the authorization chip inside the cartridges, and they figured out their own version, and then they approached Nintendo and said, okay, we've got our own, and we're going to start to knock off cartridges. And they were like the first licensee or something. But it was this whole thing for the longest time where all cartridges were manufactured by Nintendo themselves, and that's what that whole seal of quality thing meant.
So that was 25 years ago, and I think definitely the NES started the long death march of, two things. I think arcades, obviously, they went away. You know, they haven't gone away, but it definitely killed what we knew to be arcades in the 80s, probably by the mid-90s. They were pretty much gone. And then, you know, ultimately, PC gaming, which is still around and strong in many ways, but certainly not like it was, you know, until, I guess, really the Xbox and PlayStation arose out of, you know, what NES sort of, I mean, go further back to Atari, but, you know, agreed, I guess, that is sort of, I think the NES was kind of the first arcade quality, you know, gaming console.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think that was its big point. I mean, I remember going into a store and seeing the NES for the first time in a game playing on it, and it really was the first time I saw something where I thought, this looks as good as something I would pop a quarter in to play. Mm-hmm. It was just a shocking leap for me because, you know, I'm coming off the Intellivision and Atari era.
Yeah, which were, you know, cool at the time, but they were, you know, almost crappy compared to the NES.
Although I'm still such a huge fan of the Atari 2600. So,
how do you think the popularity of consoles in the 80s affected the popularity of personal computers? Do you think there was any, you know, cross-pollinization there, or with either the technology or people's exposure to the technology making them think, hey, this is pretty cool, maybe I'd like to do something besides just play games, maybe I'd like to go ahead and have a computer? Do you think that had any effect at all?
You know, Earl, it's a good question, and I guess I'm going to say mostly no. I think certainly it had to on some level. You know, there were a few companies like, what was it, the Atom, you know, ColecoVision Atom, you know, where they tried to make a gaming machine that became a computer or vice versa, and, you know, sell them in toy stores, which obviously there could be lots of other reasons that didn't do well, you know, just where it was marketed, how. I think gaming consoles, personal computers, they were just they weren't considered the same thing, even though there's a strong gaming community around personal computers. I think even now, you know, today, again, with, you know, like, who is it, Blizzard, that's very dedicated, you know, StarCraft and, I don't play these things, Warcraft Online or whatever, you know, that's all PC-based, right, and Mac-based. Mm-hmm. But then you have people that they've flat out will only play games on consoles, and then you have strong PC, you know, natured gaming people. Does anybody do into gaming?
Oh, sure, yeah, I'm a big gamer. Both console stuff and the PC and Mac-based gamings. And yeah, I'm a Warcraft player, I'll admit it. I do think that I think maybe it contributed. I think a contribution did go the other way, though. I think things like the Atari 400 and the Atom, I think a lot of those got sold because the existence of the keyboard let the kids convince the parents it's a computer. Oh. Uh-huh. But really, it's they want to play games. I pulled that trick off for a number of different units when I was young.
But by 1985, I believe that there was computers that were on Time Magazine's cover, and so on. I think at that point, you began to see the divergence of computing again, and the consoles, especially the NES, was the beginning of that divergence. I think it's reasonable to say that when you bought an NES, you probably also had a computer somewhere else in the house. It was getting to that point.
Yeah,
I agree.
Okay, so next up is a new biography of John Antonasoff, and it's called The Man Who Invented the Computer. So, Bill, you can speak to this, and I know there was some discussion on the March discussion list quite a bit about it, about his computer and whether it was really a real electronic computer and all. So go ahead, you take it.
Well, first of all, I would say that there are four ideas that John had. Binary code, not ideas, but incorporations of binary code, non-ratcheting logic, serial calculation, and regenerative memory. Those four things, are vital to the having a computer. In 1940, when he was working all these plans out, a computer was a generic term that we don't use today. It was different than we use today. A computer was a device for a machine for calculating math or doing addition or doing, large numbers of number crunching. But what has emerged in our consensus of today is that a computer should be something that allows you to enter a program or some sort of stored program that the computer can absorb and use those instructions to operate, whereas earlier computers were, especially analog computers, were designed for a specific purpose. You might have entered in a few numbers. You might have flipped a couple of switches or moved a couple of cables around, but they were generally only designed to perform a specific function where the program wouldn't change. And I think that's where the argument is about whether or not John Antonasoff actually invented the computer. And it was whether it was Mauchly's ENIAC. But clearly, there's an influence. I have a letter, actually, from Mauchly to Antonasoff describing how he asked, may I use some of your ideas in my computer or my project? And I think that it isn't really important whether somebody has a first. It doesn't really matter, I don't think. But I think it just is important that that John, his ABC computer, and remember, it's also not just him, there's always others, but Barry as well, be recognized for what it was that they did. They pushed the ball forward one more notch, giving an opportunity for John Mauchly to use the notes and the inspiration that he gained from seeing the system that came before his. And, of course, it wasn't just Mauchly, but Eckert and everybody else that was involved funding it and the government and so on at the time. So everyone was really mostly interested in making something happen around World War II, and so it was really a national effort.
Yeah, there was a really interesting court case. I haven't read this biography, but I know the court case in the early 70s, judge ruling whether that patent case, ruling whether or not the ABC, what was it, the Antonasoff Barry computer, whatever, like how much the ENIAC owed to that and that kind of stuff. And I remember reading a history of that ages and ages ago. I read a different biography. I'm trying to find it on my bookshelf.
1973.
Yeah, it was something like that. I remember reading a biography in the late 80s. If anybody wants to see a vintage approach on this, I've got it on my bookshelf somewhere. Here it is. Okay, so Forgotten Father of the Computer. And it was really good. It was a book good enough that I held on to it. So it's Clark Mollenhoff. Mollenhoff. So he wrote a book called Forgotten Father of the Computer, all about this, and covers the court case, that kind of stuff. And it's an interesting take because it's from, what is this, from 1988. Oh, and I see, and there's like 20 copies or so on Amazon, including some used ones. So you can pick it up for just a few bucks. And it's really good. And that's the only biography I've ever read of this, and they cover the court case. And the whole thing is very, very interesting. This guy was shockingly brilliant, and just did the most interesting things that other people built upon.
I'll put that in the show notes that I'm trying to find on Amazon.
There's another book. It's called The Computer Establishment by Catherine Davis Fishman that has some interesting, apparently relatively factual description of the whole court case and what happened. It seems as if the University of Iowa and there wasn't a strong desire to patent any of this, and so that's part of the reason why he doesn't get as much credit, because it wasn't looked upon as something to patent, I guess, or he just wasn't, or they just weren't as interested. He wanted to patent it, but the university never bothered.
And I want to mention again about Bill's group, March, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists. You know, they have a discussion group. So Evan Koblenz, who's the president, Bill, I guess,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And yeah, he had made some comments. I have a book in front of me by Scott McCartney called ENIAC, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the World's First Computer. But he said, it is imperative that anyone who reads this book also read Scott McCartney's ENIAC book. The thing about the ABC is it wasn't a computer. It was purely a calculator. Why? It could not run a program. Yes, Mockley saw it, and no, he didn't use any of the ideas in ENIAC. And he
said
that's, a few
that's
other
completely
things.
I completely disagree. I can read you a
quote. Oh, you disagree? Okay.
I can read a quote from Mockley. For example, a number of different ideas have come to me. This is Mockley writing to at Nassoff.
Okay.
A number of different ideas have come to me recently, meant commenting computing circuits, some of which are more or less hybrids, combining your methods with other things, and some of which are nothing like your machine. The question in my mind is this: is there any objection from your point of view to me building some sort of computer which incorporates some of the features of your machine?
Okay.
And so on. So, I mean, he stayed at his house for, you know, a few days, took the machine apart. I mean, there was no doubt about it that when you're talking about the removal of ratcheting logic, of mm-hmm. stored memory, of binary code and so on, you know, binary didn't appear in the ENIAC, but it wasn't because he didn't, you know, Mockley didn't want to. But there's obviously an influence. I'm not sure if you know what I mean by the ratcheting, but the whole concept of going from mechanical to tubes and whatnot was one of the biggest and most important steps during that World War II era, to go from like a Babbage type machine into what we have as a modern computing machine in the 50s. Well, for then, what became the 50s machines.
Okay. I didn't mean to start any friction back at March.
we argue all the time. It's great.
I just remember he had made some, you know, I had read some interesting comments he made, and he had mentioned this book, so that's why I brought it up. But, okay, well, good.
No, it's perfectly fine, yeah.
Okay, next up, I'm going to bring up the GitLamp documentary. I pre-ordered and purchased a copy of it, and I know, Carrington, you had mentioned you have a copy of it, and I guess, Earl, you have a copy of it?
I do.
Bill, did you happen to see it? Are you aware?
I saw it at Hope, and I pre-ordered my copy, so I got my little emblem
coin.
Medal.
Oh, so we can all compare coin numbers.
Does everybody have their coin number handy?
No, I don't. Not with
no.
I'm 0792.
0973.
I beat you.
See if I can dig it out here. I might have to grab my glasses.
And Jason Scott. Yeah, he's the guy that did it. He'll be pretty...
You know, I used the documentary. I'd been working on a PDP-8 to get that up and running.
Oh, cool.
And the on one of the disk packs was Adventure. And so I'd been working on it for about 6 months, and I finally got the clue that I needed to make it work. And I had repaired one of the serial boards on there. And by watching that documentary, I actually got a clue on how to get into the cave by watching the actual location that they, you know, that inspired the Adventure cave. I actually was able to use that to figure out how to get in. So,
wow.
That's amazing.
Ironic, but
I enjoyed the whole thing, but you know, I've never had any particular interest in caves. Or anything. I'm sure they're cool, interesting. I wouldn't mind going in one. But you know what I mean? It's not something, you know, but I found it extremely interesting. You know, the
it's
whole
fascinating that they used
a
real cave as the inspiration for what they were doing for that game.
Yeah, I never knew that. Were you, Earl, were you a big Tex Adventure gamer?
I very much enjoyed Tex Adventures, but I'd have to say I wasn't very good at them. I never finished Zork 1, even though fairly recently my son and I took a crack at trying to finish it. We didn't succeed either. So now we brought even more of the family into the mix. Now my daughter is being the map maker for us as we're trying to work our way through Zork 1. I love GitLamp. We had the privilege of having Jason Scott here in town in Portland, we had a great location, a kind of internet cafe and meeting place called Backspace. And it was hosted by the PDX Commodore Users Group and came to town. And yeah, we had food, we had a good screening, big, projection screen with a very good audio. And then afterwards, Jason spoke for a while and entertained questions. And yeah, he's definitely not bashful about getting up in front of folks and, laying it out. And but one of the things that I really appreciate about Jason and his documentaries, both the BBS documentary and GitLamp, is that he kind of lets the people that he's interviewing tell the story.
Yes.
The documentaries become a montage of snippets from the interviews where you go from the beginnings, all the way through to, in some cases, the bitter end of whatever the topic is that he's talking about.
He doesn't talk at all, in fact, I don't think, right? I mean, rarely.
Yeah, just a little. In fact, I don't know if there's no narration or just very small amounts of narration, but the narration that you do have in the documentaries is text.
Text, and there's the occasional, you hear him asking part of a question.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. His style is just fantastic. I really enjoyed the BBS one, which is, free to watch online. And I intend to buy it, though, from him as well, because I want to own it. And I just, think support what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually stated on his site, I think, that, sales of that documentary's picked up, too, because of GitLamp, which is good news. But yeah, I've seen some, YouTube and other videos of him, and it seems like he can definitely get up and just talk for a good long time.
And I think there's video of the talk that he gave up on Vimeo. If I'll try and dig up a link for it for the show notes. But
please,
there's a video of the interaction that he had with us after we saw the screen.
Oh, good.
And I think you guys beat me on the coin number by a mile. I have 2149.
Oh,
but. But I got a question for you. Do you guys have a signed copy of GitLamp?
No. I don't.
All right, now I feel better.
You win, Earl.
I show the BBS documentary in the first day of class for the students.
Nice.
To get them kind of the feeling for what the class is going to be all about. And I have a signed copy of that.
Yeah, I'd recommend the BBS documentary as well. Like anybody listening to this podcast
should
definitely pick up both of these documentaries. Definitely. Yeah,
absolutely agreed.
Okay, so next up we're going to discuss, I asked everyone to bring an eBay auction to the round table, and it's fun, what the heck, and I guess what I'll do is I'll follow up, most of these are active auctions, I'm pretty certain, so I'll follow up on the show notes page when they end, maybe put a few blurbs there, or maybe you guys can make a couple comments on your own, we'll see how that goes. So how about, first up, Bill, is you, what would you like to highlight?
Well, I'd like to first just make a comment about the Xerox Alto eBay auction that ended recently. Just really quick,
please.
Just
yeah,
to
no
say
problem.
That was certainly not an original Alto. It was an Alto 2 XM, which was the last one that was produced. An exact copy of it, almost. It was demonstrated at the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. And although it is a great computer, and it's certainly historical, I felt like perhaps it was a little bit misleading that the auctioneer did not mention that fact that it was not the original Alto, although I did contact him and he did reply back about it. But I have plenty of pictures of that same computer on my website if anyone's interested.
$30,000, I mean.
Yeah, that was probably, I'd say, that even if it was worth, that was pretty high. I just wanted to make a comment to say that you have to really be careful. So now, with that in mind, leading into my first choice, I selected as a first one to highlight, I'm not sure if I should give you the number or just mention that the subject is IBM Personal Computer 5150 and Keyboard.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Okay. Now, the reason why this is a classic example of why you have to know what you're doing when you're making a bid and doing a purchase. This is actually an original IBM 1664 system.
Hmm.
But it's misleading because you see a newer keyboard in front of it. So what somebody had done is grabbed a keyboard from 1984, but the computer itself is not from 1984. And if you look at the back of it, and the pictures that are supplied, you can see that the person, for some reason, either because there was a flash shine right there in the middle, but you can see they put little blocks of graphical blocks where the serial number would be. And you can see, though, there is no B, no circle B by the HiPot stamp. So if you were going to make a purchase, or if you were going to bid on this, looking at the other prices of IBM 5150s, there's a good chance this one would be an original version. It may even have the black power supply in there. So from a restoration standpoint, this would be a good one to get started with. It has the original card that came with it, and it's got a monochrome card in there. So it's going to take some work, but for $50, you're going to get yourself the original IBM PC. And as a collector, this would definitely be a good starter piece if you were looking to rebuild yourself the original version of the IBM PC.
Well, you know, I have one of these, and so mine looks just like this, and I'm no big expert on it, but it does have the, you know, it says it's an IBM 5150. So me looking at it, and I wish I had it right here, I could look at it, but I don't. But I thought that one of the telltale signs of an original one is that it had the cassette port, and that after that original one, they didn't put that on there any longer. So that's
true,
huh?
Right. The XT has no cassette port, but the IBM 5150, there was two models. There's the original 16K, the 64K motherboard, and then there the later version has the 64 to 256K motherboard. Right. Yeah. So in order to identify the two, between the two, there is a B stamp in the middle of the back, and that's without having to open it up. That is one way of telling whether or not you have the first version of the IBM PC or one of the later ones.
And when you say the middle, I mean you mean literally like to the right of the big fan thing above the keyboard?
There's a HiPot stamp.
I see, yeah.
And there should also be a circle B. I might be wrong and where there might be a risk is that it appears as if this person either intentionally or not copied over or blacked out all of the serial numbers and there's a identification plate on the back with the with like the serial number and then there's another one that kind of tells you what kind of model it is and what the power supply information is. It looks as if the seller used Photoshop to put a black box over that because there was a glare or whatever. So those things are missing. It's unlikely that somebody would rip those off. But if you look really closely, you can see there's a black box there.
Right.
So those two things take away from the auction, make it less likely someone's going to bid high on it. Therefore, you're going to walk into a 16K, 64K, 5150 for a lot less than any of the other auctions that happen to be on eBay at the same time who are above $100, and you're not even getting the original version. So it's a way of sneaking in there and getting yourself a much better or much rarer 5150, and you can throw the keyboard away.
Doesn't matter.
You know, that's from a PS2. or maybe not a PS2, but it's not a
Like an XT probably or it an AT. That's an AT actually.
Yeah, so it doesn't go with the computer. So again, you have to know what you're doing. But
I have one. I have the original keyboard, and let me just say, don't let me hit you with it.
I don't think those keyboards are terrible.
Huh?
I'm a fan of the Model M's pretty much across the board. So
yeah, it's just not original, is all.
Yeah,
oh, a bunch of keys along the left.
From a collectability standpoint, yeah, that's the issue. Okay,
collectability. I'm the guy who rips open all the shrink wrap. I don't care about collectability.
Well, I think maybe I would say. I'm not as interested in the condition. I'm more interested in exploring the actual thing. I don't care about opening whether it's shrink wrapped or any of that stuff. I'm truly a hands on. I want to work on this. I want to fix this. Kind of a guy. Collecting the original boxes and all that stuff. If it comes with it, great. But if not, you know, I'm more interested. Do I have the original version of something? You know, so I can find the little mistakes. Usually, that's where the interesting stuff is. All right, I've got one more here that I think is really interesting. The title is Vintage CompuGraphic Corporation Computer Boards. And these are what you would have called flip chip, although that was a trademark of Digital Equipment Corporation. These are boards that you would have found in a business computer that was used to do what eventually became desktop publishing and photo publishing. So this is historical. Because the CompuGraphic company furnished those machines that you would have had to have a lot of money at the time for to process photographs and put do digital processing. So in the early 70s, this kind of a computer would have been used for what eventually became desktop publishing and photo processing.
Yeah, and so these would add, like, these would add different, you know, fonts or styles and that sort of thing?
Right. You would use these for publishing, okay. Publishing magazines and so on. So you
and that
would,
was,
yeah,
man,
you,
that was like, that was magic, wasn't it, at that point, from what they call it, the hot lead, you know, printing press, and then the
Linotype.
Yeah, and all that stuff. So this, the Compute, yes, Graphic was a miracle.
So this was for photo typesetting. This was a very advanced system for its day, and it was a specialized piece of equipment, which of course eventually a company like this is going to go out of business as a general purpose computers and scanners and so forth became available. But at the time, this was the only game in town if you wanted to do this kind of work. So for that reason, if you're interested in the development of graphical processing and so on, this is one of the branches of tree that led into the desktop publishing world.
Okay. I can actually comment on that. Strangely, I have a history working professionally with these. My family, growing up, owned a company called Valpak, which was at the time the largest largest cooperative direct mail company, and we used CompuGraphic systems or machines, and then eventually, like by the late 80s, it was AGFA machines, or mid 80s or so. And I think AGFA actually bought CompuGraphic. But I had to learn to work these machines. I did desktop layout on them. I hated them. And then I think it was around 88 or 89, we switched over to starting to use very, very basic Macintosh machines to start to lay up things, and it was a major change. We went from like a Friday using AGFA machines and had a weekend training seminar for everybody, and then Monday morning it's like, okay, here's your 2CX or whatever it was at the time, and we're now doing layups on like that, and then eventually went direct to film and direct to plate printing. But yeah, I actually had to struggle through and learn these systems, and it was a bizarre sort of you'd enter a bunch of codes, and then you sort of had to do everything in your head. So you're writing. It's sort of like imagine having to work with a PostScript printer, but you don't actually have any WYSIWYG stuff. You're actually going to type out the PostScript commands, and then when it comes out of the printer, or in that case, when it comes out of like a little film feeder, you take a look at it and you say, "Oh my goodness, why is the E the size of the screen, and why is that left instead of right, and that kind of stuff." So, and it wouldn't actually these things wouldn't lay out a full page the way that we would think of doing desktop publishing now. It would lay out little bits of things. So you'd say, okay, I want this line rendered in this type and this size, and whether italic or whatever. And then I want this line, and you'd actually, and I want a little decorative flourish like this. So you'd actually print out the little pieces, which would then be given to a paste-up guy who would use an X-Acto knife and cut up the little bits and bobs and then paste them down on a page. And then that page would be shot, and you would do your printing from there. So it was all these stages. And so you can see why the desktop publishing idea of sitting in front of something like a Macintosh and actually seeing the page and moving things left and right and visually looking at what your results will be was such a massive leap forward over something like this. It was huge. So, but looking at these, it brought back such huge memories. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's my childhood. I hated these things.
So, yeah, from a historical standpoint, it's a lot easier to own these few chips than to have the whole system at your house.
And they're very interesting. If you look at the picture of, you know, like the main picture with all of the boards of the eBay auction, you know, that would make a nice picture, you know, frame them up, put them in a showcase or whatever and hang it on the wall would, you know, be very interesting to look at. I like circuit boards. One thing to mention, I guess we didn't do on the last one is so as of this recording, this has got 6 days, 8 hours left. It's at $9.95, no bids. And then your other one, let's see, was $49, I think, Bill? Yeah, $49. It's got 3 days and 20 hours.
Yeah,
left.
And my criteria was apparent low price, mm-hmm, obscurity, and poor auction design to keep something that's going to make it likely that you're going to get a good value.
Okay.
Shipping will be low for this, obviously.
All right, so next we'll move to Earl. And so go ahead, Earl.
Yeah, I just had one item that I wanted to talk about. I found a Commodore Super Pet, the SP9000 unit, up on eBay. It's kind of an interesting auction. The Super Pet itself, I find to be an interesting machine. Folks who have listened to RetroBits know I'm interested in computer languages, and the Super Pet was the granddaddy from the Commodore perspective of computer languages. It was a collaborative effort put together between Commodore and the University of Waterloo in Canada. They wanted to build a machine that they could use for instructional purposes. And the thing has a variety of computer languages available for it, you know, including some of the standards like BASIC and Pascal and Fortran, but even, you know, a couple more obscure languages, at least from the microcomputer perspective. It had Micro COBOL, Micro APL. And so when I saw this auction, now I see these every now and again on eBay. They're kind of rare, but it's not like you never see them. Maybe you see one every few months if I was hazarding a wild guess. This particular auction, it's not clear whether the machine is 100% functional for a couple reasons. One thing they were saying, they didn't have all of the software that goes along with it. The other thing is that the pets would connect up to their disk drives using the IEEE 488 interface. Mm-hmm. And apparently, for some reason, and they're very clear about this in the auction, which I found refreshing. You know, it was a very honest assessment of where the item's at. They're saying that they tried hooking up a disk drive and they couldn't get it to work. They kept getting device not found errors. And so they're saying, assume it's not working.
Right.
You know, one of the interesting things about this auction, though, if you actually look at the pet itself, at the body of the pet, it looks like it's in really good shape. I'm a pet owner myself. I have a pet 2001-8N. It's one of the 2001 models that has the full-stroke keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you from my own personal experience and from watching the forums that if you're a pet owner, you probably should get used to the idea that at some point you might have to do some maintenance on your machine. I mean, they're obviously some of the oldest computers that came out of Commodore. I can't speak to how well they were built when they were coming off the assembly line. I've never heard any bad stories about bad QA, like, for instance, you might have heard, you know, with the Commodore VIC-20 and 64, when they were being built, they had a pretty high failure rate. But, you know, these machines are just getting old enough where at some point, you're probably going to have to get your hands dirty. And it's not too hard to do on a pet because you take a couple screws off and the case pops open kind of like the hood of your car. And the innards, as you can imagine, are fairly simplistic. You know, the PC board layouts are not too complicated. So, but the Super Pet, interesting because it was a dual processor machine. It had a 6502 in there, and I think... was the other chip a 6809?
Yes, well, according to Wikipedia and the auction.
Yeah. So I mean, and you could switch back and forth between the processors. And the 6809, I believe, was the chip that you would use if you were going for the language support.
And interestingly, because I thought the Super Pet was essentially a black and white sort of a Commodore 64, you know, in a Pet case, which it says it's got 96K of RAM though. And the guy doesn't mention that in the auction, but that's it's got way more ROM too than the.
Well, it's an 8032 mm-hmm. Commodore PET with the addition of 64K add-on board, and depending on which version he has, that was integrated into the 6809 board as well.
It looks pretty dirty.
That was my concern with that one. The price
on
is
the
right.
Inside.
Yeah, just yeah. The circuit board. Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like there may be a little bit of rust, but he does have a prompt, and it does at least come up, which tells you that at least the 6502 is working.
What I find interesting is that little switch, or two switches on the side there. So I guess you switch between the two processors, and then one's called Prog. Do you guys see
that? Yeah, there was actually, as I recall, there was like a read-only mode.
There's two
that
switches.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Well, the other switch has Prog, read-write, and then read.
Mm-hmm. It has to do with the bank switching of memory as well. So there are definitely things that they could have done to make it a little bit easier to work with. I've actually done some development on these before, and in Pascal, one of the things I think that they could have done better was make the Waterloo version of Pascal and BASIC and whatnot were different than the Microsoft. Everyone's always fighting against Microsoft. So it's unfortunate that this system just didn't quite – it was almost really more intended almost as a terminal that you would write your computer code with and then you would upload it to a mainframe and actually run your programming.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the documentation uses that as illustration. So if you would find very little documentation that came with this computer that would actually tell you how to print your output or how to, you know, do interesting things like you would find on a Commodore 64.
I have a PET, and it's, you know, I should know this. It's either a 4032 or 8032, and I just did a round of presentations to some of the user groups here in the Atlanta area. Yeah, I keep it in good shape. It's cleaned up, and it works. Other than now, a number of the keys aren't working.
That well with my 2001, you have to fiddle with it a little bit. All of the keys are working, but they're touchy. So, you'll find people on the internet forums that talk about how to take the things apart, mm-hmm. how to clean out the keyboards. It's very exacting work to try and do this, but you can actually restore the keyboard to its initial factory state if you want to take it apart and go through the effort to do it.
Okay, so let's move to Carrington.
I have a couple. They're related. Unlike Bill, I didn't select them based on anything other than I think these are things are cool. I believe both are vastly overpriced for what they are. But I cut my teeth on these as a kid and haven't seen them in ages. So that's why I just found them so interesting. I had originally looked for something Apple related because it's more my purview. But I couldn't find anything online at the moment other than a copy of Championship Loadrunner. But I think that's overpriced as well. But there's a vintage, there's a DEC H500 Logic Trainer. And I had a different version of this. I don't even remember which model it was. And it was this little box, one of these little Logic Trainers, was the first thing I ever had pre-computers, before I had an Altair, before I had anything. I had one of these that, and I think it was an aunt gave it to me, that she picked up at a garage sale. And essentially these are little boxes you get, and they'll come with a manual, and the manuals for these things are normally easily available online. So, and you use this to teach yourself the very, very basics of using logic gates. Like this was how I, the very first step I ever took to becoming a programmer was one of these logic trainers, which is to teach you what does a logic gate do and how does it work in a very visual sense, where you'll use little wires to temporarily connect up a circuit and see the results. And this was it. Like this is the door I walked through. A box similar to this, but it was slightly different. So it must have been a different model. I don't even remember the model now because it was like 10,000 years ago. But it was one of these that was the first thing that told me this is what the idea of a computer is. This is what an AND gate is or an OR gate and why that matters. And so it was the first step. And then related to that online at the moment is a Heathkit one. And the second thing I ever bought, after for maybe 2 weeks loving that first little logic trainer, I stumbled across a Heathkit microprocessor trainer. I think it was the ET3400. Online at the moment is a 3700, but they're very similar things. And there was a whole range of these Heathkit things. And the different models would train you how to work with particular microprocessors. So there's they exist currently. Like you can go to Heathkit and actually buy one based on Motorola ones. And you'll learn the very basics of programming a microprocessor from one of these. So it'll be a kit. You actually plug in the processor. Most of these kits come with a range of different processors that they're compatible with, but it comes in like a little plug-in processor card. And so you'll get the processor and some auxiliary chips. You plug them into one of these little trainers, and then you'll have a guidebook. And all the trainers work basically the same, where they'll have a little solderless breadboard at the bottom, and you will basically wire up temporarily a little circuit that your trainer will show you how to do, and it teaches you circuit design and also how you would program with circuitry. So these two things combined. Now, both of them are not really particularly collectible items. They're both going for like basically $150 plus shipping. You can generally find these sorts of things much cheaper than that. So I'm not necessarily recommending these particular auctions.
Mm-hmm.
But this as an idea, and a lot of people I don't think, if they came later to computing, wouldn't even necessarily know that this sort of thing existed. Like, so before I had the Altair, before I had any sort of programming prompts at all, I learned the basics of the ideas of programming with this sort of trainer. The Heath kits in particular can be found very, very cheaply, and the original original manuals that come with them are usually available online as well, just for a few dollars. So you can actually assemble a full training kit just like you would have in like the late 70s or early 80s and get a whole Vinci system for very little money usually.
Now, Carrington, on the DEC one,
right,
the Logic Trainer, which is $149.98, buy it now. Those symbols, I'm trying to remember my electronic symbols. So, you know, the rectangles top and bottom, what are those?
These are basically just your little AND and OR gates. And so what you'll use is with one of these first trainers, you actually will turn a gate into, make it an OR gate or make it an AND gate, make it an XOR gate, and then that's why those comes with those little wires. And
yeah,
you'll actually plug them together and you make your own gates. And so the idea was that each of these can represent multiple sorts of gates, and you'll turn it into an AND, an OR, a NOR, that sort of thing.
But what are those?
See how the logic flows through
underneath the boards that you're plugging into. Do you know what are those rectangles? And then those are not transistors in the middle, right? Or are they?
Oh no, those are just to create little. Again, it's the whole thing. The whole thing was just to create logic gates, and you're assembling the C. And then then you'll have little pulses, and you set it up to say, okay, I want to send a pulse through. What does go through? What doesn't go through?
Okay.
Can this add? Can this not add? And so that sort of stuff. So this is what 6-year-old Carrington spent 2 weeks playing
with.
It's
just essentially a plug board.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time, it was I thought it was like a peg game or something. She handed it to me. I'm like, well, what is this thing? How do you play this? Is this like, do I roll a marble around it? What do I do? And then, but
that
mine came with a photocopied sheet of how to use it. It was basically a photocopy of the manual, and it was different looking, and it had a few less switches on the bottom. But it was essentially the same sort of idea. You plug it in, and then you have little switches to send pulses through, and then it teaches you the very, very – I mean, you can't do much with these other than learn what an AND gate is, what an OR gate is. But for me, as a 6- or 7-year-old, I think I had this, it was just a mind-blowing new concept of, oh, I get it. Like, that's how these things – these computer things work. So it was just when I came across this, I couldn't resist this being my pick, even though $149 is about $100 overpriced, I think.
This really brings back some memories for me, too. Radio Shack, with their science fair kits, had something similar where you would wire up different gates. And that was actually my first experience with binary mathematics.
They've had dozens of those over the years. I have about 4 of them, I think, in my collection, different ones.
Yeah, the Radio Shack one didn't work very well. At least the one I had, the contacts would kind of come loose. But, I mean, it worked long enough and well enough where it gave me a grounding in binary. I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. I get it now. This is what's in the guts of a computer.
Well, the Vintage Digital DEC Computer Lab Logic Trainer is $149.98. Buy it now. The Heath Kit Microprocessor Trainer, Carrington mentioned. So there's actually 2 different models, but I guess they're very similar. So there's 2 available at $149.99 each, or you can make an offer, Bill and Earl, so you both can get one. you don't got to fight over it. And just to mention about Earl's auction, that I don't think we mentioned it, the Commodore Super Pet 9000, it is an active auction. It's had 4 bids, so at the moment it's at $5.71 with 6 days left. So this, I'm sure, I'm seeing how much it would cost to ship to me in the Atlanta, Georgia area. It would be $94.79 Canada Post expedited.
That's what I'm seeing as well.
Okay.
So that may be just a generic ship to the U.S. And I probably the shipping cost is what's driving down the actual price of the auction, combined with the fact that some of the circuitry may not work.
Yeah, so it'll sell. Obviously, it's got bids, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see how much
it goes for. If you're in Canada, this would be a good one to go for.
Carrington?
Yeah, the shipping for within Canada is about $43. So
that's
it's
a
not,
bargain.
It's not
We're counting on you.
Us Canadians, typically, I mean, that's the thing that kills you if you're outside of the U.S. The vast majority of things on eBay, particularly technology things, are based in the U.S. So when you look at buying a piece of hardware, sometimes the international shipping is just outrageous. So it makes things more expensive. eBay is already a pretty expensive place to go shopping.
And that's
Weren't you guys saying earlier that this was one of the top viewed
Yeah, there's 30 watchers right now.
And you knew that from Collectors Weekly? So could we touch on that? Because that's totally new to me.
Yeah, if you look on folks, we have a shared document we cheat from. So if you look on there, there's actually a link, and I'll put this in the show notes, to Collectors Weekly. You can sign up and get a weekly email newsletter sent to you, or you can just visit the webpage at collectorsweekly.com. There's a section, Computers Fall Under Office. So, office/computers. But I've been wondering, does anybody know how do they get that information out of eBay?
Yeah, they have a link that says how this works, and they explain how it works.
This is totally new to me. I'd never even heard of this before, so I appreciate the link myself.
I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not a virulent eBayer because I just have so much to already work on. I don't, I mean, the whole purpose of what I'm working on, in Wilmington, that whole project is to try to get it under control. But this shows you really what almost not to bid on, because because if you're not going to get a good value if you know you're going to be competing with 30 other people who are watching the same item, but it does give you an idea of comparison purposes and in general the pulse of the what's interesting to people. I'm very surprised to see a Timex Sinclair ZX81 is number two right now. It's the British version. Something I don't know about the interest in these over in England, but in the United States, a unit like this would be $5. So it's interesting to see those kinds of things. And I do frequently go and take a look at auctions in Germany and England, although I rarely buy anything, because you do find really weird and exotic items that if they were sold in the United States would go for triple or quadruple what they're going to end up selling for in Europe. So if you're a speculator, you can buy them, figure out a way to get them shipped over, and then resell them, if that's what you're into, which I certainly am not.
And I don't spend that much time on eBay buying or selling at this point, because Earl has a bit of a gripe. I think things are really overpriced. I mean, you have to really do your research. I mean, so obviously the first thing I do is look at the completed auctions, see what they've been going for, and then I start watching, and if something goes for a lot of money, usually you can wait and a couple more will come out of hiding, and then of course you can get those much cheaper. So you just got to be really careful about, and then always look at their feedback. Look, and obviously look how much they're charging for shipping too, because that's an area where people really like to scalp other people with.
Yeah, you can it's easy to overlook the shipping. And I have talked about my gripes with eBay on RetroBits, but I will say, even though it's less fun for me to browse these days, it actually is easier on eBay if you're looking for something targeted. Mm-hmm. You know that you need this kind of cable or that kind of circuit or something like that. You can get on there and the search is good and you can drill down to what you're looking for. And that actually I still find very useful.
Yeah. I have a number of saved searches that I use as well.
And I notice on the Collectors Weekly top eBay auctions, it looks like one of those, upper left there, the Altair 8800, is one that I chose. But I didn't choose it through there, so I'm... I did a search for S100, because I just thought I would... I recently wrote about Ed Roberts and the Altair and all that. And so so it's the vintage Altair 8800 computer. And these come up fairly often on eBay. It looks like it's up to $1,001. The reserve isn't met. It's got a week left, 13 bids, $100 shipping. So what I find interesting about it, it's saying that it's a nice clean one. His grandfather was a retired engineer, his or hers. Do you guys see it's got those, what are those white divider things? Is it just something on the face of it the person just put there to, now Bill, you own Altair 800, right?
Yeah, the purpose of those is to separate the octal and the hexadecimal groupings of lights.
That's just a feature added thing the guy put on there, huh?
Yeah, he just put on a piece of tape.
You're gonna you find that on about 15-20% of any Altair. And you notice how down at the bottom there is no nameplate.
Yeah.
Very often the engineer will not put the nameplate either. At least half or whatever of the Altairs. So that tells you this was a kit. Uh-huh. So that tells you this was probably manufactured or put together by somebody themselves, and I didn't actually read the description, but just by looking at it, I can see that this was hand assembled.
If you ever find one of these online that instead of the nameplate on the front, it has a sticker from the then that would be my first computer. So instead
Paradise
of putting, yeah, the very first computer I ever owned was one of these, and I had it as a kit form. And when I assembled it, I didn't put the nameplate on myself. And eventually, ages later, I put a stick sticker on. Embarrassingly, I think it's more like from the Mr. Roboto times. I had it for ages.
That's the first thing I was thinking about. No, how's it go? Nomo Bogato or whatever.
Domo Arigato, Mr. Yeah, Roboto. Sure. So
I think that's the special collector's edition of the Altair 8800 is what I heard.
If you ever buy that one, I will be willing to sign it. But I did this whole tape thing in the front as well to separate them into groups of four. I did the exact same thing.
Do you think, Bill, the leaving the nameplate off too was a sort of like people even – they want like a special car. They don't want any of the nameplates on it or –
You know,
that sort of a thing.
There must be some reason for it that I don't know.
If you have to ask.
It was before my time. I did not own an Altair. You know, I wasn't even 10 yet. but the thing is, too many people didn't put that on there. That build a kit for them. There must have been some reason. I would be very curious to know why.
I would say maybe they thought it looked better. You know what? It looks better without it. I know what it is, and I like how it looks. You know, it's just the switches and the light. You know, maybe that had something to do with it.
Hey, I have a question for everybody. The Altair 880. Do you consider that a benchmark of the general direction of prices that the vintage computers are moving? If an Altair 880 like this, if this ended up selling for $2,500, for example, would that tell you that the value of vintage computing is going up or down? The fact that it's already at $1,000.
With a reserve that's not even met at $1,000. So the guy's expecting it to go for quite a bit. I'm surprised that these still go so high now that a very authentic kit is available. So clearly it's only people who want to collect an original one. Because if you really just wanted one to play around with, you can pick up a kit, like the modern remade ones by David Briel, I think it is.
Is my voice better?
No, it's worse.
By your command. Oh, Earl, you're killing me. That's so funny. It's a Cylon. I can't believe you. Oh, my goodness.
Editor's note. As you could hear, I was having some problems with my audio. So that was Vince Briel, who made the Altair 8800 micro kit, as well as the MicroChem, Replica 1, and a few others. Is that better?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Now I know what to do. Bill, my answer is, now, of course, you know, Ed Roberts died recently, so could the Altair be, could that have anything to do with it? You know, we'll see how this auction goes. I definitely think there's some very specific items on eBay or in general that are going up in value while other things just aren't appreciated. So I think I think the Altair, the MSI, not that I can't speak from a lot of authority. I haven't looked at them that much recently. But, you know, obviously an Apple I, that's kind of almost a bad example. But an original Apple II.
You know, I think the Altair is unique in that people – it's the Mickey Mantle card syndrome that I like to call. You let's say you collected baseball cards in 1957. You put the Mickey Mantle card in your drawer, the rest of the cards you had in a shoebox someplace – 20 years later, you still have the Mickey Mantle card in your drawer, but those common cards were long ago been thrown away by your mother. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people look at the Altair as the first computer that they built on their own, and a lot of people held on to them much more proportionally than any other computer from that era. And there's a lot of very rare and unique computers from, you know, 75, 76, 77 that just there aren't even any existing copies of them yet. You see, almost always see an Altair on eBay. It may just be that the people that built them now just need money. But you know, you see, hey, this thing doesn't mean as much to me. I mean, I've had this thing lying around in my closet for 40 years, and now or 35 years. Might as well sell it if somebody's willing to give me $2,000 for it. You know, I only paid $395 for the kit.
Time for a cruise.
Yeah, but I think that this is definitely a marquee vintage computer, very symbolic of what a lot of people consider to be the real true classic vintage computing era heavy hitting computer. The debate of whether Pentium 1s are now vintage, you can argue about that till you're blue in the face, but you can't argue that an Altair is not a vintage computer.
Yeah,
and I don't know how widely known it is that the computer had such a strong correlation with Microsoft and, you know, with their kind of rise to fame. But if you look at an Altair with the switches and the LEDs and that, doesn't it look just kind of like an archetypal vintage computer? I mean, it just kind of exudes, hey, I'm an old computer, and you know, I visually look like what you would expect a computer to look like from the 70s.
I think that's a really good point, Earl. I think that actually would be a contributing factor to this. I think you're right.
Yeah, and that's the reason why the turnkey models, who look almost exactly like this, don't go for as much on eBay, even though they're only a year and a half older or newer.
Well, this brings me to my other auction then, is the ISC Systems Corporation S100 Bus Computer Model 01200. So it's got a starting bid of $150. Actually, has no bid. It's got it over a week, 20 hours ago, the $39 shipping. So here's a good example of does it work? Not a particularly attractive S100 computer. This unit can be very common. It's got a Z80. Does it say it works? It appears to start up. The cooling fans run. They don't know much else about it. So it powers up.
Yeah, this is definitely an example of a 696 era S100 bus, a later S100 bus. So this would have been a turnkey system where it would have been all based on the cards that were inside of it. Mm-hmm. But S100 was still very popular, well past when the IBM PC was launched, and this would have been one of those.
It's a cool looking old system. Is that rust?
It's a good way to get started on S100. This would be a good example of something that had a reasonable chance of having the right power so that you could put cards into it.
I mean, you know, if you could really pick this up for $150 and then $40 shipping, I don't think I would get that if I had that money right now.
This absolutely will not work without the disk controller, without the disk drive, because this has a disk controller mm-hmm. in it. So that means that this thing is going to – you're definitely going to need to have the accompanying disk drive. And this would have been a CPM system for sure.
Now, does it have a disk drive in it.
Yeah, it's got the disk drive on the inside.
Okay, there it is.
That little door, right. Yeah.
So all you need is the disk.
That's cool. Door with a key, awesome.
So you have to build the BIOS if you get this one.
Yeah, see, that's the issue there, is getting the disk.
But again, I wouldn't even – if I was going to buy this, and there's also a CompuPro system for mm-hmm. sale with no cards in it for $200.
I saw that.
You're buying this to have the power supply, the S100 bus – and a disk drive, and then from there you go from there. You could, for example, get a North Star controller, a North Star disk drive. Use the disk drive that's built in here, and you can make a North Star system with something like this. So you don't really necessarily buy this to have something you're going to plug in and start using. You buy this because this is a good box that you can build a system around with a fighting chance of it having electronics in place. Maybe the RAM will work at least.
Alrighty, I guess it's almost time, or about time, to start wrapping it up. So we're going to have our open panelist session here. Talk a little bit about yourself, what you've been up to, you know, plug your website, whatever. And because, boy, we sure can talk. Bill, you go ahead and start off.
All right, I'll be really brief.
We'll take a few minutes.
Okay. Well, I don't want to hog. but the most interesting thing that's happened lately for myself is I've gotten to the point where I'm trying to formalize what I'm doing with the vintage computing, and I'm fortunate enough to have an office downtown in Wilmington, and I've got plenty of space. So what I've done is I have a small computer repair shop on the first floor at 103 West 7th Street in Wilmington, and its decor is vintage computers. And tech, and my wife built some really nice shelves that are sturdy enough to hold computers. And when you walk in the door, you see computers and components and whatnot, and posters and things on the walls, and in a more of a gallery type artistic fashion. Currently, there's an Altair and an MSI and an Osborne and all the kind of things you would expect to see, stereotypical vintage computer stuff. But in the back room is a large room we call the ballroom, and that's going to be filled with probably about 300 or so working vintage computers.
Really?
That's where they're all going to go. So I've got everything from a PDP-8. I'll have a Heathkit EC1 in there with an oscilloscope, PDP-11, a number of Altairs.
This is all yours?
Yeah. So it's a very, very, very large number, and it's gotten to the point where I'm like, okay, I have to do something about this, because I don't have enough space at home to turn them on and just keep them running. Because it's very important to me that they're maintained properly, that they're worked on, that they're the pressure is right, the humidity is right, the temperature is right, the dust environment, that all the software is archived and backed up, and that there's plenty of workspace to take them out, put them on the bench, and work on them properly. I also host the Delaware Hackerspace at this location, featuring mostly vintage computer repairs. So we have regular repair sessions based on themes. Disk drives is often the repair theme because that's really the weak link in almost any vintage computer system. We all get together. I am beholden to the experts in the Mid-Atlantic area who've taught me pretty much everything I know about vintage computers. I'm just simply a good note taker. And, you know, I work very hard at perfecting the craft of computer restoration. I'm proud of the fact that I'm teaching a class at the University of Delaware, but really it's the people who have taken the time to show me and who were actually there at the time working on these computers have really made it possible to have what I'm hoping to be a facility for coming and doing research. On the first floor, the second floor will be all documentation and software, and it will be about 1,700 square feet of documentation, software, and whatnot. So we're talking about 3,400 square feet of vintage computer gear, not including what I'm leaving at my house, which is probably another 800 or 1,000 square feet. So there's a lot of tightly packed computer systems, and I guess I've been busy for the past 10 or 11 years getting all these things up and running. So I just wanted to give a shout out to everyone at the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists. It's a lot of fun. We have Vintage Computer Festival in May of 2011, and it's always a lot of fun to bring your computer, like a classic car show. Everyone turns them on, makes sure that they're running, and does a demonstration of them. And lastly, my website is vintagecomputer.net. And on that website, I always have tons and tons of pictures of every project that I'm involved in. And so if you're doing research or if you're working on a restoration project, use the search to see if I've also worked on that. And maybe you'll get some high-res pictures that you can use in your repair efforts. Thank you.
Well, Bill, people, you know, when I tell people about, you know, I collect computers and I have some stuff in my garage, and people always make this comment, your wife must be really understanding. So, I mean, your wife must be really understanding.
It's very important that there's not a single vintage computer anywhere except in the space that I have for that. I'm very, very, very clean about it. Nothing goes in the house that hasn't been cleaned first. I'm very respectful of everybody's space. And part of the reason why I'm moving everything out of there to free up some space so that... Is now I've got three kids, 6 years and younger, and we need more space in the house than me selfishly taking up a room for computers. So I do feel it's important not to let this is a hobby. This shouldn't be your life, and it shouldn't drive the people you know that you love and your family to have to be somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Put it in perspective. It should be in perspective.
So Earl, we'll turn to you now.
Earl Evans of the RetroBits podcast. You can find my blog and also links to the shows at www.retrobits.com. And as you mentioned, David, it used to be a regular show, used to be weekly, and then kind of fell off the truck there. And now it's kind of whenever. And what I'm trying to do, actually, one of the things that I'm making a concerted effort on at the moment is getting it back into a regular cycle. I don't foresee at the moment that it's ever going to go back weekly, but my goal is to have a release every couple weeks. And there's actually, you know, there's such an array of retro computing things that is going on in the retro computing world in our little niche here that there's never any shortage of topics to talk about. RetroBits kind of covers the whole gambit from, you know, mainframes from the 50s to, you know, computers and operating systems as late as maybe the 90s, although 70s and 80s tends to be where it sells the most. That's where the most information comes from. And also the tagline, modern day fun, I always try and look for activities that are going on today that not just focus around computers from back in the day, but also focus on projects that are going on to enhance and or further the enjoyment of those computers. So, for instance, add-on boards for the various computer models that are out there, modern-day projects to hook our old 8-bit systems up to the internet, that kind of thing. I always find that fascinating, and those are some of the most popular episodes as well. So, you know, that's kind of the direction I'm going at the moment. Personally, I've been having some fun with just some little side projects. One of the nice things here is that in the Portland metro area, we've actually got not one, but two Commodore users groups in the area. If you can believe it, there, you know, there's enough projects and activities and things like that that's actually spawned off two groups. And so lots of activities going on there. I'm getting back into some of my Commodore programming. You know, I've never reached what I would call expert status on assembly language, but it's a goal. I love languages, and you know, I want to drill down on my 650X kind of a assembly code. So I'm working on that. Also trying to blog when I'm coming up with something that I think may be of general interest. I'll stick it up on retrobits.com. One of my recent projects was connecting up a parallel iOmega zip drive up to my IBM 5155 portable. I think Bill might have mentioned keeping the old systems as pristine as you can, you know, keeping the system in its stock configuration. I wanted to do that with my IBM Portable 5155 that normally comes with two 5 1/4 drives. So I didn't want to take one of those out and stick an aftermarket hard drive in it. I wanted to keep the unit pristine like it was given to me. So I was thinking, what can I do for a hard disk? I happened upon the idea of connecting up a zip drive to it, and if folks are interested in the, you know, various troubles and travails I had doing that, you can look at it on the blog. But the bottom line is, I got hooked up, and now I'm all hard drivey with my 5155, and I'm living DOS life like it's back in the 1980s, and you know, kind of reliving some of those experiences. So just, you know, little projects here and there. Talking about collecting, I was recently coming to the conclusion that I've just got too much stuff for my house. I kind of agree with Bill in, you know, being respectful and not letting my retro collection start to ooze out into the rest of the family space. But man, when I stop to think about the different platforms that I really get a lot of enjoyment out of, like the TRS-80 Model 100, my Epson PX-8s, which have a special spot in my heart because I used to work for Epson and support that particular model. And Commodore stuff, of course, which I love. Atari, which I sold back in the retail days. And my IBM PC that I just talked about. And I just, you know, sitting around thinking, which one do I get rid of? And I just, I can't part with any of them. So I guess I'm going to have to buy a bigger house. But so that's what's been going on with me. And also, if folks want to follow me on Twitter, I try and, you know, post there quasi-regularly these days. My Twitter handle is RetroEarl. And you can find all that stuff over at retrobits.com.
Thanks, Earl. Okay, Carrington, let's hear from you.
Oh, sure. I'll keep it quick. I was for a couple years, or a year and a half or something like that, host of 1 Megahertz, which is the Apple II podcast. I've always had a love of the sort of the computers I used as a kid and cut my teeth on, but the one that always stood out the most was the Apple II. So when I looked at sort of getting into the retro computing hobby, it was sort of a no-brainer for me that that's the one I would want to focus on. So that's what my podcast is. I've started up again, which is after having taken like a 3-year hiatus, and I've really enjoyed it. Like I have now one episode that's ready to go, and the second episode was recorded last night, and I'll have to finish the audio set. I'll come in 2 weeks, and it really is just sort of a document of my hobby, and for the most part, it's playing games. I mean, what appealed to me as a kid with the Apple was programming my own games and also playing games. I was very much a consumer when it came to that computer as much as a developer. So it's me going back and finding software that I either used and enjoyed as a kid and want to look at with fresh eyes, or something that I had wanted to use. It's often the case and just never got around to it. And that's why I try that. So this new format is changed a bit, but it's very much the core of it is still game reviews. The first one was me finally getting around to reviewing this game Wasteland, which turned out to be one of the best gaming experiences I've ever had on any platform ever, and have now played it through twice, and was shockingly good, and found a very hard to find a little document that came with only the first few boxes of it, or the very first edition, and I have subsequently now scanned that and stuck it online, so I will once again be reducing the collectible value of things. So basically, people interested in the Apple II end of things, my podcast is 1 MHz and is at monsterfeet.com, and so that's where you'd find my stuff.
Well, that's going to do it for the show. A little over an hour and 30 minutes, 34 minutes or so. I think it was a great first outing, and I really appreciate my guests today, Bill Degnan, Earl Evans, Carrington Banston, and I welcome them back anytime. Had some problems with my audio, so working on that. In the future, I want to try to keep the show to about 1 hour. I think we're going to stick to one auction item is a definite there. But please tune back in approximately 3 weeks or so for the next show. Please check out my blog at classiccomputing.com. Be looking for the next chapter in Stan Beat's History of the Personal Computer, Chapter 3, coming out. And then the third, the Classic Computing Show video podcast. Thanks a lot, everyone. Together, but I still just wake up here.